This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Timothy Spall, won Best Actor Awards this year from the New York Film Critics Circle and the Cannes Film Festival for his performance in the film Mr. Turner. He plays the British painter J.M.W. Turner, whose now revered landscape and seascape paintings became increasingly radical for their time. The film follows him from his early 50s to his death in 1851 at the age of 76. The director, Mike Lee, said the film is about an artist who moved people, quote, to experience the profound, the sublime, the spiritual, the epic beauty, and the terrifying drama of what it means to be alive on our planet, unquote. Lee says he also wanted the film to capture contrasts between this timeless work and this very mortal man who was eccentric, anarchic, vulnerable, sometimes uncouth. Spall has appeared in four other Mike Lee films, including Topsy Turvy and Secrets and Lies. He also played Winston Churchill in The King's Speech, and may be best known to many Americans for his role in the Harry Potter films as Peter Pettigrew. Spall spoke with Terry earlier this month.
Timothy Spall, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on your New York Film Critics Circle Award. And, of course, the award for Best Actor that you won at the Cannes Film Festival.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, I mean, it's always a delight to get, you know, prizes you didn't think you were anywhere near going to be in the running. So there you go.
Right. Well, let's start by talking about Turner. I'm going to ask you to describe his place in art history.
Well, Turner, J.M.W. Turner, Joseph Mallard William Turner, I suppose, born 1775, died 1851, I suppose you would regard him as being the greatest, if not the one of the greatest, landscape painters of all time, and a unique artist because he was a master of the sublime being not now, which has become sort of a term for a rather charming and delicious slice of cheesecake. The sublime was a movement in art, which was something that tried to capture the beauty of nature as well as its terror and its horror. It was a movement that grew out of the Romantic movement, and again, a term which has come to mean a weekend in Paris, if you're lucky. And the Romantic movement, I know it's funny how these words lose their value by overuse, but the Romantic movement was, in a nutshell, basically the movement of art and poetry, which was about recording not just what you saw, but what you felt about it as well.
Let's talk about how you portray Turner. He is portrayed in the movie as a very visual but not a very verbally oriented person. So he seeks out visual beauty and paints it. And he's very attracted to, you know, to physical beauty, but he's not very good at expressing himself as a speaker. He doesn't speak much. He does a lot of mumbling and grunting. And I want to play a short scene in which you're kind of mumbling in character and grunting a little bit. And in this scene, you're talking to your housekeeper who has been ordering your paints while you've been away. And here we go.
Your order came.
Do you send the cobalt blue?
Put it in a jar. Chrome yellow, scarlet lake, lead white.
Canvases?
You put them downstairs for me. 2 6x4s, 3 4x3s.
McGill?
Next week.
Okay, so we hear this voice that you created for the character with the mumbles, the throat clears, the grunts. How did you end up doing the voice that way? Is there any evidence that Turner spoke that way?
There is evidence that he spoke that way. Also, it's slightly misleading to say that most of it is grunting. There are moments in it where he's very, very eloquent. And
it's true.
Speaks,
we'll hear some
you
of
know,
that
it's
later.
It's not all grunt. It's because I think what it is that he expresses his emotions through a series of noises. His intellect, he's very capable of talking in quite a sophisticated way, and it's a reflection of his autodidactic knowledge of growing out of his polymathic intellect about what he knows, although he's not a show-off. The reality is the grunts grew out of when we were discovering and trying to build a man thought a million things and felt a million things but wasn't predisposed to express them because that was the nature, his nature. He had an implosive intellect and an implosive soul that rather than express what he was feeling, it manifests itself in a series of visceral animalistic sounds.
I found myself wondering that if Turner were alive today and if he was like how you depict him in the movie, would he be diagnosed as being someplace on the autism scale? Because he's very obsessive about his work, totally focused on it, but has so few social skills. And I mean, for example, he has this relationship with his housekeeper or maid where he basically pays no attention to her, but he occasionally uses her sexually, almost like she was an appliance or something. Like, there's no warmth communicated to her at all. And he thinks nothing of it. He has two adult children that he fathered with his ex-mistress, and he doesn't acknowledge them in any way. Even when they come visit uninvited, he won't talk with them. So I'm just wondering, like, do you think he'd be diagnosed today if he were alive?
I think Turner, to a certain degree, a lot of this you've described suggests that this is just the surface of what you're seeing. I mean, there is a massive amount of subtext that goes underneath of all of those things you've described. And hopefully there that is carried along in the character. You do see him being dismissive of his children, but when he finds out one of them has died, he doesn't say anything, but if you observe it carefully, you can see that he is internally in anguish. He has this relationship with this housekeeper who remained his housekeeper and was his housekeeper for a long, long time. He'd known her since she was 14. He left her very well provided for. He did have a dismissive, slightly selfish relationship with her, but there is a odd kind of perfunctory love under that for her, although he is dismissive. How many people do you know, who do have these relationships? You know, some people's lives are based on perfunctory and dismissive relationships. I don't think he's on the spectrum. I just think he is an uncompromising man who can behave like a swine, can behave dismissively. I mean, at times he also behaves very generously. He ends up having a very loving relationship with a woman later on in his life.
So there's one woman whose inner beauty he really sees. She's not like beautiful on the outside. She's not unattractive, but she's an older woman who wears, you know, kind of white bonnet and
she is a working class
seaside
landlady, a woman of her time,
right?
Uneducated, not stupid, but a very ordinary, unremarkable person, apart from having a deeply warm soul and a person who understands this very unusual man.
Yes, so there's a scene where you can see like how they're relating to each other. I want to play that scene. She's a landlady in the seaside community of Margate. He's been renting a room with her because he wants to be near the sea because he's painting the sea. And he's using his middle name, Mallard, because he doesn't want people to know that he's the famous painter Turner. She's Mrs. Booth. And he's looking at her and seeing her inner beauty, and is she's kind of shocked that he sees her as beautiful. So here's the scene between her. She's sitting by the window, and you speak to her.
Mrs. Booth, would you be so kind as to look out of the window?
Here, what am I looking at?
From the tip of your nose, to the bridge, to the curve of your brow. You put me in mind of a Greek sculpture I'm familiar with, of Aphrodite, goddess of love.
Oh, no! Who's ever said that about my nose before? This old snout. Truth to tell, my eyes aren't so good these days, so when I do look in the looking glass, I'd be glad I cannot see so well.
When I peruse myself in the looking glass, I see a gargoyle.
Well, you'll be fishing for compliments. And my old Mar used to say, them what fish for compliments don't get none. Besides, 'tis what's within a person that do matter. I do not know you, Mr. Mallard. And I'm sure there be things about you that are beyond my understanding. But I believe you to be a man of great spirit and fine feeling.
Mrs. Booth, you are a woman of profound beauty.
Mr. Mallard, I am lost for words.
There's your grunt. So that was my guest, Timothy Spall as the painter J.M.W. Turner, and Marion Bailey as Mrs. Booth.
See, I think that, you know, all the things that we've been talking about up to a point are contained in that. You know, he does grunt, but when it's a flirtation scene. It's about two incongruous people who are just making an acquaintance and falling in love. And I'm pleased that you played that scene because it does encapsulate an awful lot of his character and his warmer side of his character and the surprising side of his character. Because when they discovered that he'd had this relationship, he kept this relationship secret. You know, he was the leading light of the Royal Academy. You know, he was a great mover and shaker. He wasn't a snob. He fell in love with this woman and he kept a secret. Okay, it wasn't because he was ashamed of her. He didn't want anybody to know anything about his business. When they discovered that this woman was his lover and had been for so long, they were appalled, because some of them were, some of them weren't, that he'd chosen to be with somebody from such a lowly background, you know. But the fact that she was from the same background as him didn't occur to them, but that is a simple fact, you know.
We were talking earlier about your voice in this film. You're from a working class background, and as you say, grew up with a working class accent or dialect. Then you went to the Royal Academy of the Dramatic Arts in London. Were you trained to change how you speak?
No, thankfully. They stopped doing that in the early 60s. When people went there, if you did have a regional accent, whether it be London or Yorkshire or Irish, they tried to inculcate the fact that that was an impediment to you, and they got you to speak what is otherwise called standard English or RP, received pronunciation, which is the kind of English that grew out of the BBC from the 1950s, where newsreaders used to wear dinner jackets and dressed to read the news, where everybody sound exactly the same and no one could be divined as to what part of England they were from. They were just generally regarded as being sort of from the upper echelons of society. Whereas now you were allowed, when I went to RADA, you were allowed to, if you were an Oik like me from South London, as long as you were able to do other accents when you were performing them, they didn't seem to mind. That doesn't still mean that every time you open your gob in England, you don't betray your origins, because you do.
So have you done Shakespeare, and did you have to do like a Shakespearean accent for it?
There's no such thing as a Shakespearean accent.
I know, but you know what I mean. Yeah.
I have played kings, I have played princes, I have played aristocrats, I have played people from all different types of backgrounds.
I want to ask you about a turning point in your life, which could have been the end of your life. In 1996, you were diagnosed with acute myeloid leukemia. Did you know something was wrong when you were diagnosed? Could you tell?
Yeah, I had to sit down every 3 minutes, and I was covered in bruises, and I was falling asleep all the time, so I had a feeling there was something wrong with me. I wasn't in pain, and I was about to go to the Cannes Film Festival, and I thought I'd just go and see my doctor, I got a call the following day. He took one look at me, didn't say anything, he just took about 5 gallons of blood out of me and sent me away, and he said, I'll let you know. And following day, he phoned me up and said, "I'm sorry, old boy, you've got leukemia." I said, "I can't have leukemia. I've got a job to do. I've got to go to Cannes tomorrow." He said, "No, my dear boy, you're not going to Cannes. You're going to hospital." So that was a bit of a life changer. I went to hospital. Mike Lee, Brenda Blethyn, Marianne Jean-Baptiste and others went to Cannes, and Secrets and Lies won the Palme d'Or, and Brenda won Best Actress. So, and the rest is history. I watched them walking down the red carpet at Cannes in 1997 with a pipe being inserted into my heart to give me the electric soup called chemotherapy that saved my life.
You know, this is an example of my theory that sometimes when something wonderful is happening to you professionally, something horrible is going on in your personal life at the same time, like you're
well,
sick
no
or a family member sick. Yeah.
Well, I'd like to take this occasion to say on air a tribute to my best friend who died yesterday.
I'm so sorry.
Well, thank you. And his name is Reynold Silver. I got an award from the New York Critics Circle, and my best friend died, and I'd like to just make this interview a tribute to him, Mr. Reynold Silver. I just thought I'd like to say that as you were saying that.
Well, why don't you elaborate a little bit more and tell us something about your relationship with him?
Reynold Silver was a dear friend of mine. I was at RADA with him, believe it or not, in 1976, so I've known him for coming on 40 years. He had the good sense of giving up acting because he couldn't take the indignity of it, and devoted his time to becoming a teacher in a very unglamorous school in a very unglamorous part of London, in Islington. Most of his school kids, well, half of them were a lot of girls from immigrant countries who'd come in from Africa and Asia into this working class part of London. And he devoted his time to trying to teach them about Shakespeare and poetry, and he did a very good job. You know, he was a man, you know, that one of the great heroes of life, I think, that people we forget. We're so used to celebrating celebrities, whatever that word means, that we forget that there are people out there like doctors and people who saved my life, and people like my dear friend Rennie, who devoted his life to teaching, not for a great deal of money, kids who really weren't expected to achieve anything academically, and he even managed to help a few into Oxford and Cambridge. So this is my tribute to you, dear Reynold.
Was his death unexpected?
God bless you. He'd been ill. He got ill about 18 months ago, but then recovered. And then in the last 2 weeks, he declined very rapidly and died in his sleep yesterday.
Well, I'm very sorry for your loss.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for allowing me to talk about him, because I loved him, and I shall miss him forevermore.
Yeah. So can I ask you, when you were very sick, were doctors preparing you for the possibility that you might die?
No, they didn't, because they never do when you have a serious, unless you ask them. They did tell me that I had they said, look, things are looking good. You've got a 60-40 chance of surviving this these days. 20 years ago, you'd have had a 70-30 chance of not surviving it. So they do point out to you that there is because the cure is so particular and has its massive side effects. It's a bit of a ride, I have to say, the cure for AML. Not everybody goes through it, but it does take its toll, but it works. And funny enough, my friend Reynolds, Rennie, I remember him calling me up and saying, I'm saying to him, you know, Ren, I might die. He said, oh, don't be ridiculous. You're not going to die. You are not going to die. You're going to be fine. You're going to outlive us all, my dear. So there you go. But, no, it did, it was a massive odyssey. It was a journey that I had to go through, and I had a growing family. I had young children and my wife, who now travels with me everywhere, not because she nearly lost me, but my kids all grow up, and my son's now a very successful actor, Rafe Spall. No, it was a very tough period, but a very, very tough period, and some people don't make it. I was one of the lucky ones. I did.
Can you think of a role that you played subsequent to your illness where you felt you were drawing on the suffering you experienced when you were sick?
All of them. It doesn't matter as to whether you have to sublimate it or not, or whether the character is, going through it. Because I think, you know, your job as an actor, particularly a character actor who doesn't act to make the character fit you, my job as a character actor is to make me fit the character, to serve the character. So you have to use massive amounts of empathy, and often you're playing people that aren't very pleasant, as in the case of Mr. Turner, a man of massive contradictions. So you need to be able to go down in your imagination and dig deep to find out what makes people tick. And I think anything that increases your understanding of the human condition, and I do not for one second profess to be in any way, special about this, because I think age and life just makes you just, if you're lucky, think deeper. And the other thing it makes you realise is that you never stop learning and you never lose your fear of getting it wrong, because I've been around a long time, but I'm terribly aware that there's so many things I need to know, you know. There's so many things I don't think I've got it right yet, you know.
Timothy Spall, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
A pleasure. Nice to talk to you. Thank you for listening.
Timothy Spall speaking with Terry Gross, recorded earlier this month. He stars in the new movie Mr. Turner, for which he won Best Actor Awards this year from the New York Film Critics Circle and the Cannes Film Festival. D'Angelo has built a considerable reputation on the basis of three albums, 1995's Brown Sugar, Voodoo, released in 2000, and now Black Messiah, unexpectedly released early Monday morning. The singer-songwriter and multi-instrumentalist has been widely praised for connecting many decades of different rhythm and blues styles. And rock critic Ken Tucker says Black Messiah is as adventurous as any fan could hope for.
Take a tote of smoke from me as you breathe it inside. Let your day slip away, come with me and ride.
My darling, you are the average kind. You need the comfort of my love to bring out the best in you. I own that checklist. See what you're giving to me.
The man who helped inspire the term neo-soul, D'Angelo, is a musician who, at the turn of this century, was seen by a lot of people as the great R&B hope. He was the creator who was to yank soul music from the mists of nostalgia, dry it off, and give it a good modern twist. He did just that on the album Voodoo in the year 2000, and especially during the tour he launched to promote it. One show I saw stands as one of the most exciting concerts I've ever attended. But D'Angelo keeps his own time in more ways than one. Thus, the decade and a half separating Voodoo and the new Black Messiah collapses years and genres, sounding at once stuck in time and timeless.
She needs to thank you. She loves it. I just wish that I could open up. Her price things came over home. Late seconds got another charm. Ow, ow.
Shoulda, shoulda, when it tossed that toy. Yeah,
the way she make the congregation sway.
That's Sugar Daddy, an irresistible little piano groove that more or less refuses to give up its lyric, which is multi-tracked and slurred and generally messed with to the point of incoherence. I like the song a lot, though I do wish D'Angelo had deigned to enunciate a clever line such as, "You say you want to be the one she chooses to star in her meaningless romance." A lot of Black Messiah is like this, long discursive jams that tiptoe over the five-minute mark, hallmarks of Loverman balladry. But each jam is its own reward. Check out the country blues of The Door.
I know you want, but why? You want
All is not sensuous playfulness. 1,000 Deaths begins with a soundbite from The Murder of Fred Hampton, a 1971 documentary about the Chicago Black Panther shot dead by the police. The lyric has a first-person narrator talking of being locked and loaded and hoping he'll be unafraid to face death. If it wasn't for the Fred Hampton excerpt, you'd think it was about someone in the military rather than civilian militants. The music is a dense thicket of noise, with the rhythm section laying down a line of fire amidst the chaos. D'Angelo makes a point of saying in the album credits that he does not consider himself a black messiah. For me, he writes, the title is about all of us. It's about the world. It's about an ideal we can all aspire to. Which is as good a cue as any to point out that messages and lyrics have never been D'Angelo's strong suit, which is why I assume Kendra Foster, a George Clinton P-Funk graduate, gets co-writing credit on 8 tracks here. This album is credited to D'Angelo and the Vanguard being collaborators including singer-lyricist Foster, drummer Questlove, and horn player Roy Hargrove, among many others. Together, they make frequently beautiful music.
As the day must have its sun, and the night must have its moon, sugar's bowl must rise and fall. I'll be there to see you through, just as long as there is time. I will never leave your side. In the belly that you feel, that my love is not sincere, I will never betray my heart.
Given how long he worked on this rich, thick music, I know I'm going to be spending a lot more time teasing out more meaning from Black Messiah. He's no messiah, and I'm no blind worshiper, but I do know that the faithful will be rewarded with repeated listenings.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Yahoo TV. He reviewed D'Angelo's new album, Black Messiah. Coming up, John Cleese of Monty Python talks about his early days in comedy. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross.
Well, I mean, it's frightfully kind of you. The poor are going to be absolutely thrilled. Have you met them at all?
Who?
The poor?
The poor?
Oh, you must meet them. I just know you'll like them. Charming people. Of course, they haven't got 2 pennies to rub together, but then that's because they're poor.
That's John Cleese as Robin Hood in a scene from the 1981 film Time Bandits. Cleese was a member of the Monty Python comedy group and co-wrote and co-starred in the films Life of Brian, Monty Python and the Holy Grail, The Meaning of Life, and the TV series Fawlty Towers. Cleese has written a memoir called So Anyway, which covers relatively little of his 50-year career in radio, television, film, and theater. It's about Cleese's childhood, education, and his early years in show business, when he wrote and acted in British radio and television, working with his future Monty Python collaborators and others, including Marty Feldman, Peter Sellers, and David Frost. John Cleese spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies last Tuesday.
John Cleese, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
You know, you play an upper-class Englishman so well, a lot of people probably figure you were born into the nobility. Tell us about your
family. Yes, I know. I came across a friend only 2 weeks ago. I'd known for years in Santa Barbara, an English guy formerly with the BBC, and he'd exactly got that impression you describe and was quite surprised to discover how ordinary and plebeian I was.
You had a good education. Your parents sent you to public schools, what we in the States call private schools, and mm-hmm. and you went to Cambridge and got involved there in the Footlights, this performing troupe. And you were a tall, thin guy. When you got into Footlights, what kind of roles did you first play?
Oh, I see. It affected me a lot earlier when I was at school, where I was at 12. I was taller than any of the masters. I think by the time I got to Cambridge, there were enough 6 foot four, 6 foot two people around for me not to stand out that much, not as I had done in my preparatory school when I was 9 or 10 years of age. But I don't think it really had anything to do with the kind of roles I did in the Footlights, because all I did when I started was I had good timing, but I didn't have any other skills at all. You see, Graham Chapman, who was in a show with me in 1962, he was a really top-class mime artist. He could do very funny, very, very original mimes, and he could also sing, and he could move quite well. I couldn't do any of those things at all. I could just write some reasonably good jokes and time them well off the audience. And that was all I had to offer for a number of years. The other skills, the more physical comedy, came quite slowly.
You said you always had good timing, even early in your career in comedy. And I wanted to listen to an example. And this is a scene from Fawlty Towers. That's the TV series you did in the 70s, written by you and your wife then, Connie Booth. A lot of Americans will remember this series. You played Basil Fawlty, who runs this hotel, and is kind of a bit of a discontent with his life. And this is an episode where a bunch of Germans are visiting the hotel. And this was when, you know, World War II was still a relatively fresh memory. And you, as Basil, you've had a concussion, so your thinking is a little off. And you're taking a dinner order from the Germans, obsessed with not bringing up anything about the war, which, of course, you then fail to do. So let's listen. One of the Germans speaks first.
May we have 2 eggs mayonnaise, please?
Certainly. Why not? Why not indeed? We are all friends now, eh?
A prawn cocktail.
All in the market together? Old differences forgotten, and no need at all to mention the war.
Sorry, sorry. What was it again?
The prawn cocktail.
Oh, prawn, that was it. When you said prawn, I thought you said war. Oh, the war. Oh, yes, completely slipped my mind. Yes, I've forgotten all about it. Himmler and all that. Oh, yes, completely forgotten it, just like that. Sorry, what was it again?
A prawn cocktail.
Oh, yes, Eva prawn, yes. Yes, and Goebbels, too. He's not going to hardly remember at all.
And I'm pickled herring.
Hermann Göring, yes, yes, and von Ribbentrop's, that was another one.
And 4 cold meat salads, please.
Certainly. Well, I'll just get your hors d'oeuvres. Hors d'oeuvres, which must be obeyed at all times without question. Sorry. Sorry.
Will you please call your wife immediately?
Sybil! She's in the hospital, you silly girl!
Yes, call her there.
I can't. I've got too much to do. Listen, don't mention the war. I mentioned it once, but I think I got away with it all right. So, it's all forgotten now, and let's hear no more about it. So that's 2 egg mayonnaise, a prawn Goebbels, a Hermann Göring, and 4 cold salads. Oh, wait a minute, I got a bit confused here. Sorry, I got a bit confused because everyone keeps mentioning the war. So could you... What's the matter?
It's all right.
Is there something wrong?
Will you stop talking about the war?
Me? You started it?
We did not start it.
Yes, you did. You invaded Poland.
It's got my favorite pun in there, which is hors d'oeuvres that must be obeyed at all times without question. I hate puns normally, but I do like that one.
Yeah, that's our guest John Cleese from the series Fawlty Towers. That's one of the better known bits from the series. Do you remember these fondly?
Oh, yes, yes. I remember them fondly and with a certain relief that I got them done, because to get a half hour done in those days was quite an achievement, even if it was no good at all. The very act of having recorded a half hour was an achievement because the conditions were so poor. When I came to America and was lucky enough to do things like Cheers and Will and Grace and Third Rock from the Sun and saw the superb conditions, rehearsal and so forth, and the number of writers around are constantly polishing lines and making suggestions, it really was the Rolls Royce way of making comedy. And in England, we would go off to a little London church hall somewhere, and the walls of the set would be indicated by bits of coloured tape that had been laid out on the floor, and then the chairs would be awful broken down old things that had been, you know, bought at a junk sale or something like that. Whereas in America, you rehearse on the set all week and you get used to everything. You get used to the height of the desk and the weight of anything that prop that you're going to pick up. In England, they were all different. When you got in the studio for the one day you were in the studio to record them, everything was different and you had to adjust all the performance that you'd been rehearsing the previous 4 or 5 days. So to do the amount of pages we did, which was a very large number, we used to do 140 pages, and the average BBC sitcom was less than half that, was about 65 pages. To do all that, to learn all the business, and then to make the transition to a new studio and set where everything was slightly different, and then record that starting at 10 in the morning and kicking the audience out at 10 at night.
Wow.
It was unbelievable. It was just one mad rush.
And a lot of physical comedy in there, too.
A lot of physical comedy, exactly. And that's the stuff that takes a long time to rehearse. So how we got it all done, I don't know. And looking back, you know, just had this sense of relief that I don't have to do it again.
You were a tall, lanky fellow, and, you know, you're known for great physical comedy, you know, struts and all. I mean, how did you learn that?
I think I learned it by imitation because I was no good at physical comedy. I was a terrible dancer. I danced like an Englishman. And although I had good hand-eye coordination, I was so tall and skinny and muscularly weak that I just was not well coordinated. But what I started to do quite early on was watch some of the great old silent comedians like Laurel and Hardy and Chaplin, and then later on Harold Lloyd and Buster Keaton. And the first thing you notice about these people, how extraordinarily physically skillful they were. And I began to just learn a few little things like how to look as though I'd tripped, or I was good at balancing things. I could take an umbrella and balance it on my chin or on my foot. And I just got interested in that kind of thing. And as I played games more and more and got stronger physically, I just became more coordinated. But by watching the great old comedians, I picked up a few tricks about how to do physical comedy, and whenever I could learn something, I sort of added that to my repertoire. But it was not a thing I was naturally gifted at. It actually was sort of work, but it was fun work.
One thing that you're really good at as an actor is indignation. That come from anywhere? Did it modeled on anybody?
I don't know, but it's quite true. I think it's I've always found life quite difficult to explain to people or to myself. I think there are so many activities going on, like mountaineering, that, you know, you would pay good money not to have to do that. And yet there are people racing out who want to spend their spare time clambering up rocks. They're just, you know, other people, you know, put a latex rubber on in order to become sexually excited. There's so much I don't understand. I don't understand why very, very rich people want to have even more money than they've already got. And I think that I feel an indignation when I don't understand something. So I think a lot of it, the dead parrot is the perfect example of the indignation, is that my character simply does not understand why the pet shop keeper will not accept the parrot is dead, because he clearly is. And it's that building indignation that I always find funny.
You tell a wonderful story about Peter Sellers. You know, Sellers was great at voices, just watching somebody and picking up a character. And
that's right.
You tell about a story arriving at his house one day and seeing him in the morning. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do. And it just showed why he was such a wonderful impersonator. But it showed that in a very strange way because he'd overslept. And his chauffeur, Bert, said, "Sorry, boys, Peter's overslept. I'll make you coffee. You'll be out in a bit." And we just sat there sipping coffee. And when Peter came out, he was still in his dressing gown or his robe. And he was apologizing for having overslept, but apologizing in a voice that was not his own. And suddenly he switched into a rather sort of plummy upper-class voice and was talking to us like this as he walked towards us. And then a moment later he's talking a bit like that, as though he's a cockney down the east end. And then he went into another voice, sat on the sofa, and 10 seconds later he was talking to us in his own voice. And you see, we were the first persons that he'd spoken to that morning. So he'd only just been up a few minutes. And we realised when Graham Chapman and I sort of compared notes afterwards, we realised that Peter Sellers, in the morning, had to find his own voice.
So he wasn't trying to impress you. It's like somebody tuning on a radio dial and finding the station.
There was a lack of real personality at his core. And the people who were very good impressionists are often rather like that. Similarly, people who write very good parodies but don't write such great original comedy, those people often lack a certain emotional life. They're very clever, their observation is good, but emotion doesn't inform their work in any way. So their work tends to be brilliantly observed, but not very, what's the word, not very powerful. They don't tend to be terribly funny. They tend to be terribly clever. So this kind of personality type, a person who has a quite weak sense of their own identity, they're frightfully good at copying other people, whether it's other writers or other performers. But we realized that Peter literally had to find his own voice in the morning, and to that extent he was a sort of a personality that he'd had to manufacture himself from different parts. And one of the Pythons was ever so slightly like that, and we could always tell when he had been spending time with one of his Beatles friends, because he would have a slight Liverpool accent for the next 24 hours.
And which Python was this?
It's Eric Idle. Eric, he was very close to George, and thank God managed to find the money to make Life of Brian. But you could hear a slight Liverpool sound in Eric's voice for a time, and he was our best mimic.
I want to play a clip from Life of Brian. This is where you, as leader of the revolutionary anti-Roman group, that is it the People's Judean Front or the the Popular Front for the Liberation of Judea?
I have no idea.
One of them.
But there were a lot of those kind of groupings. Right. You heard more about the ones on the left, but they had these very fanciful titles. And what was amusing, that their infighting was ceaseless, and they were always splitting into two groups because they couldn't agree about anything.
Right. So in this clip, you are Reggie, who is the leader of, I think it's the Judean People's Front. You're planning a caper to kidnap a Roman. But in this conversation we're about to hear, you're essentially talking about how much you hate the Romans. Let's listen to this.
They take everything we had, and not just from us, from our fathers, and from our fathers' fathers.
And from our fathers' fathers' fathers.
Yeah.
And from our fathers' 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 fathers.
All right, Stan, don't labor the point. And what have they ever given us in return?
The aqueduct? What? The aqueduct?
Oh, yeah, they did give us that. That's true, yeah.
And the sanitation.
Oh, yeah, the sanitation, Reg. Remember what the city used to be like?
Yeah, all right, I'll grant you, the aqueduct and sanitation are two things the Romans have done.
And the roads.
Well, yeah, obviously the roads. I mean, the roads go without sand, don't they? But apart from the sanitation, the aqueduct and the roads...
Irrigation. Medicine.
Huh? Education. Yeah, all right, fair enough.
And the wine?
Yeah, that's something we've really missed, Reggie. The Romans left.
Public baths.
And it's safe to walk in the streets at night now, Reg.
Yeah, they certainly like to keep order. Let's face it, the only ones who could in a place like this.
All right, but apart from the sanitation, the medicine, education, wine, public order, irrigation, roads, a fresh water system and public health, what have the Romans ever done for us?
Brought peace?
Oh, peace! Shut up!
It's a very funny piece, isn't it?
It is. John Cleese in Life of Brian. Funny. It is very funny. And, you know, I love your performance as Reggie there, but it's the writing that really makes this wonderful, isn't it? I mean,
yes, that's right.
You say many times in the book that you're more a writer than a performer.
Well, it's always hard for people to believe that because, of course, any time they've seen me, it's because I've been performing. You know, they don't just go to their televisions and switch them on and see me sitting at home writing, you know. So naturally, people's image is of a performer, but the reality of it is the writing for me has always been the most important thing and the most rewarding thing. And performing, just closing the circle, because I'm less likely to screw it up than anyone else. But there's another reason. When you do comedy in front of an audience, they are the ones who tell you whether it's funny or not and which bits are funny and which bits need to be fixed, so that when you start performing it in front of an audience, say on stage when you start in a show, it's a very interesting process to perform it, because it's like a series of little scientific experiments each night to try and make things work that didn't work the night before. And as you've got it to the point when you think, now I know how this needs to be played, we've made some cuts, things that didn't work, we've rephrased certain things, we've found that to play these lines with some anger, but these lines with no anger at all, this is now makes it funny. And that's the point where I want to say, well, that's the end of the experiment as far as I'm concerned. I want to move on to something new now. But, of course, a proper actor will be happy to do that on stage for several months. And I don't have that temperament.
John Cleese, it's been fun. Thank you so much.
Good. That was fun. Thanks.
John Cleese speaking with Dave Davies last Tuesday. Cleese has a new memoir called So Anyway. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.